Ways and Means for February 9th, 2005. Mr. Williams, you're back up here.
And thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. And seated to my left is Linda Gilbert, who is our gas budget analyst. She can also help respond to any particular budget questions that you might have during the course of the presentation from the DAS perspective. I'd start just by again thanking the committee for their time yesterday and for the additional time that you took following the hearing, and hope that you found the tour of the women's facility and our intake facilities at Coffee Creek both valuable and perhaps thought-provoking. We just again extend to you the offer, if there are particular questions that arose on your tour or in any of the materials that we provided you or in the discussion yesterday that you'd like us to be responsive to, just please feel free to let us know, or you can let Mr. Wilson know, and he'll communicate with us, and we'll make an effort to make sure that we weave into our responses to the issues that you've raised in the remaining part of our presentation, both in Phase 1 and Phase 2, answers to your questions. We did review today some of the issues that were raised during the hearing yesterday and have assigned out to the respective individuals to either directly respond to your office with the issue that was raised or to weave in some additional discussion on those issues in the next phases of the budget presentation. I thought what I'd do, if we could, if you'd bear with me this morning or this afternoon, is to move ourselves, just instead of starting right out with cost control activities, to refocus this a little bit. I thought I'd move to the graphs that you see on page 18 and 19 of the presentation, and to walk you just briefly through an understanding of the size and allocation of the department's funds and how those are done. If you look on page 18 of the presentation materials, you will see an all funds breakdown in pie charts, both for the 03-05 legislatively approved budget and the 05-07 governor's recommended budget. As you can tell, is easily determined by the shading, the general fund portion of the budget is the biggest piece, and obviously is the primary source of where the department gets its revenues. There are a couple of anomalies that we thought were worth pointing out to you in this presentation, because I think it's important to sort of understand the history, and we've talked a little bit about this. But you'll notice that on the 03-05, there is a substantial portion of the pie that is identified as federal funds. That is the reflection of the one-time federal money that came out of the federal government during the 03 legislative session, and it reflects a substantial increase in the amount of federal funds that the department had ever received. It was considered to be a single-time allocation from the federal government to the states in a block grant style approach, where it was then up to the states to determine how they wanted to use that resource. And the 03 legislature chose to put that money in the Department of Corrections budget and then to take the general fund that it had offset to use in other places of the budget. So you see this one-time increase in federal funds reflected. That amount was about $116 million. So the $121 is reflective of some additional federal fund money that's which is typically called the SCAP money, which is used for purposes of offsetting the cost of alien incarceration, that the federal government has traditionally made some contribution to the states for those costs. That money is typically not in the president's budget. It has been usually added by Congress. And I think, and I haven't reviewed the president's budget in the last several days, but I would guess that it was not appearing in this president's budget, which means that we're not certain of whether that SCAP money would actually be available. But we plan and prepare the budget as if it will be, since it has traditionally come through at some point in the process. Mr. Chairman.
Yeah, Mr. Williams, just so that the committee understands, and I know obviously the analyst has been here and Representative Hansen has been here quite a while. That $116 million came as part of a federal, in a sense, relief package to states. There is a lot of pressure put on Congress to give some type of relief to states there were about probably 48 out of the 50 states with fiscal problems during that biennium or their fiscal years. And I believe the amount was about $40 billion nationwide, and our share was a little bit over $200
million. I think it was
$20 million.
$20
billion.
And
oh,
half of that,
$20
billion. Roughly half of that was of Medicaid enhancement.
Right.
And then the rest was this general purpose, Mr. Chair, the general purpose block grant, which we, this was the amount allocated to Oregon.
But in our case, we chose to use it to basically fill in a goodly portion of it, to fill in a need in the corrections budget. And if we hadn't had it, we would have had to just fill it with general fund dollars.
That's correct.
So,
yeah.
So are we saying that the general fund, Mr. Chairman, was like instead of 800, it should have been 900 to keep current level?
Right. I mean, it's instead of seeing.
So we're only looking at a $172 billion increase.
Maybe a little bit less than that, because you're about 916 roughly, right? If you include, or you have a, but you're about 116 of that 121 was the federal relief package,
right.
And so you're at a, you're going from about 916 to 1072, so.
And I've got a sheet behind here which I can also, which will, I think, display this in a more detailed fashion as we move through this. But this graph is worthy of at least a little time, because it does demonstrate the substantial amount of one-time federal funds that the legislature chose to put in corrections budget last time to offset and use those general funds for other purposes within the budget.
Yes.
I guess what I would ask then from the chair or Doug is, what was 2001-2003 general funds? What was that amount?
No, I didn't bring my notebook. I can probably find Sue. Do you know offhand?
It was actually not that dissimilar, I don't think.
But it was how much?
About
790. So the same. And
but the corrections budget jumps each time they open a new facility. And
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, it's not even so much just opening the new facility that causes the jump, but as we, it jumps as a function of our population. So as the population continues to grow, and you'll recall Ms. Porter mentioned that in the last biennium, the corrections population grew, I believe her number was approximately 10% was what was the estimated number. So what you see is a function that even if we're not opening a new facility, as we open a new facility, what you have is the startup cost. But even when we don't open a new facility, as you crowd additional inmates into an already existing facility, you still have to increase the staffing levels in order to account for that, along with the inmate health care costs, along with clothing, food, and all the other responsibilities associated with that growth. So simply not building doesn't mean that the budget doesn't increase. I'd also reflect on this first graph under the 03-05 portion. You'll note the $27 million in other funds. Most of that other funds component in the $27 million component was a reflection of very little construction money that was made available in the 03-05. Some money for the completion of the and moving forward with the construction of the Warner Creek facility in Lakeview, but very little else in the other funds category. Now, as you move to the 05-07 budget, you'll see that the general fund amount has increased and the federal funds money remains very, very small. Which is, again, an anticipation, more a hope than anything, that we'll get the federal SCAP money to offset some of the cost of the alien incarceration. But you'll notice the $177 million increase is the amount in other funds to get us essentially to the level of authorization for the moving forward with MADRS and the build-out of Coffee Creek, which will reflect it in the governor's budget. So the big black pie getting smaller and the small white part of the pie getting bigger, I wanted you to understand those two relationships. One is an increase in construction with respect to the other funds, and one is a substantial decrease in the one-time federal money with respect to the black portion of the pie.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes. Thank you.
Representative Hanna.
Thank you. Director Williams, I want to get the math right. So if I was going to just say, if I took the $1,072,000,000 less the $799 from a year ago, it would look like you had a 32% increase in budget. But let's say we back up from the $121 million that was the federal, so we take $116 million out of that.
Mm-hmm.
Rework the math. Now we got a 16.5% increase in the budget, and we have a 15% increase in population projected. Will that trend follow? I mean, those are big numbers.
They are big numbers, and I think what will be helpful, if the committee would indulge me, would be to wait to address your question until we get to page 21 of the presentation. I think we can walk through those percentages in a way that I think is going to give you a sense. But there is no question that there is a direct relationship to the long-term growth of and need for reliance on the general fund tied to addressing the increasing population projected for the department, the inmate population. There's no question that those are directly tied, and I think I'll be able to reflect some of that in our further conversation. I wanted to just then take you to page 19, which is another couple of pies, and this is again an effort to reflect where, with respect to the general fund, and this is only general fund that you're seeing reflected in this chart, with respect to the general fund, where the resources are used within the department, there are some anomalies in these numbers that you need to understand in relationship to the fact that we had $116 million of federal money we spent like it was general fund money when it was in our budget. So the differences in some of the proportional relationships you'll see is primarily a reflection of not having that money in the 05-07 budget, therefore impacting the numbers with respect to general fund expenditures. But you'll see, and I really want to sort of spend most of our time focused on the 05-07, 60% of the general fund money would be spent in operations, in the operations division, which is running the institutions, supervision, care, custody responsibilities for the inmate population. You'll see 4% is spent in the administration and central administration. The general services piece of the budget is about 4%. I want to have you focus for me just a minute again on the transitional services portion. It reflects as 20% of our general fund budget, but that includes the community corrections grant funding. So you've got almost 16% of that. If you could draw a little line there, 16% is all of the money that comes through the Department of Corrections and back out to community corrections, leaving you actually less than 4% that's actually spent by the department internally on transitional services and programs. And then you'll see the debt service component is 11% of the overall general fund allocation. I'll point out, at risk of sounding like this is maybe more confusing than you want to hear, you'll notice that the debt service is in 03-05, 13% of the general fund. Again, the reason that number is higher in 03-05 was we had less general fund and we had the other funds dollars included, so it was a higher proportion of the general fund spent on debt service. Debt service has increased, but the proportion in relationship to the overall general fund money has actually decreased, even though the raw number with respect to debt service has actually increased. And I hope that didn't make that too confusing for you, but I wanted you to understand the changes in relationships to these percentages as you factor in the appearance in 03-05 of that federal money and then its impact in not having it in the 05-07 budget. Are there any questions about either of these charts and the representation of how those resources or general fund resources are allocated in the department? I'll take you then next to the chart on page 20.
There's only one question, and I can wait for an answer. Is in terms of you're trying to do comparisons from one biennium to the next, because you're just doing a general fund on page 19.
Mm-hmm.
could you give the committee, not today, but later, how the $116 million was used, which areas it went into?
We would be happy to do that.
Probably most of its operations.
Mr. Chair, I believe we put almost all of it into operations.
Yeah.
I'd be surprised if any of it went somewhere else. If it was, it was small amounts,
okay.
But we'd be pleased to talk about that. And that would account for the substantial difference, again, in the relationship between the 52% and the 60%, is, again, a function of most of that money being spent in the operations division, the other funds' money. On page 20, again, this is reflecting very much some of the very same information, but in a different manner, that lets you see the difference and the relationships of the difference. You'll see that the other funds amount increases by 536.7%, and that's simply a function of having very little construction other funds money indicated in the governor's or in the approved 03-05 budget versus what's recommended in the governor's 05-07. Similarly, you'll see almost the inverse relationship with the one-time federal money coming out and the net change reflecting a 96.4% decrease in the available federal funds. The impact of the all funds amount being at 32.2% is, again, a reflection of those two things essentially offsetting one another, the construction money offsetting the lack of the other funds money, and then tied to the areas of increase, which we'll talk about a little bit on the next page. You see both a position relationship identified there of the number of additional positions that are identified and then the impact on FTE reflected in the differences between those two budgets. And we can now move to...
Yes, Representative Hammer.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Yesterday, one of the things that struck me, and I know several of us, it looked like in the facilities themselves that there weren't as many people working as we thought there might be. I mean, when you walk through the facilities, you say to yourself, there aren't that many visible people working. You know, there's a couple people standing here watching 120 beds or whatnot.
Right.
Yet, when you look at this page, I mean, it makes it look like you're adding 962 inmates and you're adding 427 full-time jobs. It didn't, I mean, that's hard for me to equate. This doesn't look like what you saw in the facility. How do we describe that? And I guess further, as we look down the road, and maybe you're going to get to this, but as we look down the road, are we always going to be adding proportionately the number of full-time equivalent work positions to that many prisoners? Because it doesn't look like that. It doesn't match.
Yeah. Mr. Chair and Representative Hanna, I certainly appreciate the question. And I think, again, it gets to the issues of the of some of the complexity of running a 24/7 operation. So for every inmate who requires supervision, that supervision is 24/7, which means that for every person that you saw watching a housing unit, that person, when they work their eight-hour shift, there's somebody who relieves them, and then there's somebody who relieves that person, and then there's somebody who relieves those people when they're out sick or they're on vacation or they're in their week's worth of training, their in-service training. So there's not only the coverage of the operation from a 24-hour-7 perspective, but then there's also the built-in necessary relief factor that you have to deal with people who are responding to, you know, bereavement leave or their own medical leave or a variety of factors. So the snapshot that you got on an afternoon, you have to recognize is sort of multiplied by the fact that we run a 24/7 operation. So there's a day and a swing and a graveyard that are managing those institutions, and we staff them very carefully to maximize the utilization. So you were there in the day, and I will tell you that you saw more people in the day than you would obviously see on graveyard when people are actually in bed and sleeping and there's a lot less activity going on, and yet there still needs to be a certain core minimum level of staffing that we accommodate. Other areas where there are people that you might not have seen necessarily as you were walking around would be folks working in the physical plant, you know, making sure that the boiler systems were working right. You saw the folks in master control, but there were other people in various parts of the facility that we didn't tour to that were doing various services. But I would tell you that it is a leanly staffed operation all the way through. And again, it would be difficult for me to sit here today and tell you that the trending would match essentially one for one, because clearly when you open a new facility, you know, you sort of get to a tipping point where you're finally at a point where you have to open a new facility, and then when you staff that new facility, it requires that you hire a certain number of boiler operators and a certain number of people to perform those basic functions that you don't necessarily have to hire in the same proportion as you're crowding a facility. But then once you pass that point, you have to lay that foundation in order to operate that facility. So it's sort of, I would suggest to you that instead of a proportional relationship, it sort of tricks along, and then it has these step-up areas.
You've got to cover your overhead at some point. I mean, just like any other business. And so you've got to fill the spots and build it, and they will come. And then at some point you reach a more productive level in terms of all the folks you've got there. But
and if I could, and I don't mean to interrupt you, Mr. Chair and Representative Hanna, we don't necessarily build it and staff it entirely as if they were all going to come tomorrow. As we open a new facility, we ramp the staffing up in proportion to the inmates that are coming in. So we don't take a Madras, hire every single position on day one, knowing that it will take, you know, some period of months to get there. We bring people on as we need them to actually manage the inmate population over time.
I think I understood that. But you understand what I'm looking at just in the pure number. It makes it look like for every inmate, for every 2.25 inmates or something that come, we'd have an employee. I mean, and just begs the question.
And I think when you look at our overall numbers with about slightly less currently than 4,000 positions and 3,900 FTE and a population of almost 13,000 inmates, I would suggest to you that that's the ratio that is probably closer over the long term. And I'll talk briefly with you with respect to some other, in the discussion we're going to have a little bit about some of the cost-saving issues, we can talk a little bit about some of the staffing and standard reviews that we've gone through in an effort to do what we could to ensure the right mix of staffing throughout the department to operate at what we would consider to be minimum safe levels, not where a lot of people would like us to be from various other standards, but at what we consider to be minimum safe levels for staffing purposes.
Any additional
questions on the sheet on page 20? If not, I'll take you then to the sheet on page 21. This is similar to some of the information that I had provided members of the committee before the hearing, but what it really reflects, and what I'd like you to just briefly walk through, because I think these get to some of the issues about some of the increases in the budget that are not connected necessarily to just purely the population growth. You'll see the $799 million number is the legislatively approved general fund number from last session. And then the boxes below that are essentially the changes or additions and subtractions in this governor's budget that are in addition to that base number from the 03-05. And the first amount, that $63,989,000, are really non-optional payments that the Department of Corrections is required to participate in. Both our PERS adjustments are included in there, the identified merit step increase, the phased-in positions and roll-up costs as a result of our various bargaining agreements, our inflation component, both standard and our exception inflation, and then the increased state government service charges, those things that were required by the Department of Administrative Services or other agencies to pay, and that gets you to the $63,989,000 figure. The next box reflects the $115 million adjustment in the fund shift. If you look over on the left side, what I tried to do is also give you the impact of the percentages effect. So the $115 million is 14.5%. So as I've tried to point out to people in my conversations, if the governor had not allocated a single dollar additionally to corrections but for replacing that one-time federal money with federal funds, the Department of Corrections general fund budget would still show a 14.5% increase simply because of that single accounting transaction. The $18 million in the box below that is to restore House Bill 5077 operating reductions that the department took as a result of the failure of ballot measure 30, and then the assigned vacancy savings, which the department was singled out among several state agencies in order to make the budget balance. We were instructed to hold positions vacant to achieve $11 million of savings, which the department did. The next box, the $12,250,000, and the governor restored both of those components in his budget. The $12,257,000 number, this number covered the costs associated with the beds that we phased in during 2003-05. Again, simply because we were told to slow down on the construction of MADRS and our other projects, it didn't stop the fact that inmates were coming into the institution. And so we added the 441 emergency beds and also started doing some of these county rental beds. And what this number is, the $11 million number you see there, is the cost of carrying those temporary emergency beds forward through the next biennium and those rental beds forward through the next biennium. And then you see the 24-month amount for the debt service in 03-05 for the COP sales for the MADRS facility, or excuse me, for the Lakeview facility, which is the $1.3 million. On the bottom there, you see two reduction numbers that tie back to community corrections. There are adjustments that were in the governor's budget, which were reductions to the overall community corrections budget, and so they operate as a negative. And that's the $195 million, which I've generally referred to as the non-growth general fund changes, in the sense that these changes are primarily not being driven by the 05-07 population forecast. They were driven by other growth, obviously, in the 01-03 and the 03-05, but not by the future growth anticipated in the 05-07. Below that box, then, you'll see the $61,424,000 figure, which is the operations costs of the 100 beds that we will be adding at the Shutter Creek facility in December of this year, the startup of Warner Creek, the 400 beds in September of 05, and then the additional 324 beds at Coffee Creek, and the operational costs associated with the 864-bed minimum at MADRS and some limited startup costs for the medium. The MADRS minimum will come on towards the end of the biennium, but it will be operational before the biennium is over and therefore requires operational resources to be dedicated to it. And then the last piece till you get to the general fund changes then is the $16 million of additional debt service tied to the sale of the COPs for both MADRS and Coffee Creek that are reflected in the governor's budget. And that's how you get to the 34.2% increase in general fund for the department. Are there questions on the general fund?
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Mr. Williams, on the $16 million of additional debt service, do you have an estimate of what that'll cost in the next biennium when it's completely rolled up?
I don't know that I have it. Do you have that number?
I doubt it.
We'll get you that number, Representative Hansen, Mr. Chairman. I think it is part of the material that we're going to actually share with you tomorrow with respect to our discussion about costs associated with moving forward on MADRS and various alternatives. And I'm getting probably handed it to me right now. And I'll see how quickly I am at deciphering a sheet that looks like this on the fly. I believe the number is in the 07... In the 07-09, it looks like the combined total of debt service for MADRS and Coffee Creek collectively would be $32,264,846. And that'll be, we'll roll those numbers into a broader presentation as we move into the construction discussion more fully in tomorrow's presentation.
Mr. Williams. An additional request for information, just because I think it's important to understand the conditions under which your agency has had to operate. Could you give us, not right now, but some kind of a view of what's happened in the agency over the last maybe 3 or even 4 years in terms of retirements. I don't know if you've had the same kind of exodus that some agencies have had, but I assume that you've had a significant number of retirements. Not right now, but could
sure. And I would be pleased to do that. We can provide you that information. It is information that we've calculated and done ourselves, so we'd be pleased to share it with you.
Yes, Mr. Chair. So, Director Williams, do you know what your turnover yearly? 20%, 30%?
Mr. Chair and Representative Wisnett, that number might be close. I want to get specific numbers from my Assistant Director of HR to make sure that we're giving you an accurate reflection. I can tell you that for positions within the department, even in just in internal promotion and movement, if it gives you any sense, about a thousand of our 4,000, almost 4,000, are in the process of some sort of change in position or promotion. So that you may be just about right on with that number.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The follow-up to that would be, do you have people that are retired and you hire them back about their PERS benefits? I'd like to know how many, and also I would be interested in knowing when you're hiring your new people, what percentage are you hiring at classification step one or two?
Okay. Well, we'll be pleased to do that. And I think what you'll, Mr. Chairman and Representative Wisnett, will be happy to give you that information, both with respect to the retirees. We do rely on retirees coming back in a number of places, particularly in our areas where we have difficulty recruiting. They fill an important service for us also with the experience level, obviously. And we can get you the classification in this area. I would tell you that I think in our correctional series, you'll find that we're pretty good at hiring at that initial step. In some of the particular specialty areas involving, for example, our healthcare professionals, because our salary structure is so vastly non-competitive, when we're hiring nurses and the like, we typically end up having to hire at the high end of the step in order to be at all competitive within the salary range.
Yes.
Follow up, Mr. Chair. I have a lot of constituents, Mr. Chair, right. They're concerned about the people retiring and being hired back, and I think I'd have to agree with them to a point of if it's prevented. I understand if you can't replace them, but I think I've always been told we're all dispensable, and I'm come from a system that's up or out. And, you know, you have the turnover, you want new people coming in, and you want them coming in if you have a classification system, you want them coming in where the classification is set up. At the lower level, and they work their way up. You don't set up a classification system and bring someone in at step four or five. Otherwise, you're defeating the purpose of the classification system and the step. So that's a bias that I have.
And Mr. Chair and Representative Wisnett, we'll be pleased to get you all the detail on that information.
Yes,
Mr. Chair, Representative Wisnett, just to make sure, I mean, if Mr. Rogan, which is using the example of nurses, it's not the department that generally sets the classification levels. It's generally DAS and others that set those compensation levels. So in some of those hard-to-recruit areas and medical care, mental health, some of these are throughout state government are all facing that same issue. And it's, you know, it's whether or not, you know, you want to raise that for the entire state government. It's not unique to DOC.
Yes, sir. Thank you. And I do think that there's an issue there in terms of being competitive for those specialty areas like nurses. There's also an issue of finding someone that is qualified that wants to work inside an adult correctional male facility in particular. It's not quite like working in a doctor's office, to be honest.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, it gives me an opportunity to talk about this issue because it's one of the things that I think is presenting a significant challenge to the department. We talked a little bit yesterday just about our constitutional requirement to provide a certain level of health care for those that we hold in custody, and yet it is one of the greatest challenges I've had in the last year is to keep impact our healthcare system within the Department of Corrections, staffed and operating at an appropriate level. We have a substantial amount of vacancies in almost all of our health areas, whether it be nurses, nurse practitioners, pharmacists, pharmacy techs, doctors, and dentists. And as a result, it does make it difficult and sometimes more costly for the state when we're required to provide those services relying on an outside service provider because we have not been able to fill a position. So, and I can use an example of a recent situation where I had to petition the Department of Administrative Services to allow us to exceed a DAS imposed, governor imposed, you're aware of the administrative restriction on increase. Where I was going to lose a pharmacist that would require me to close down my pharmacy on the east side and have to contract those services out for a substantial amount of money because I wouldn't have a licensed pharmacist that these pharmacy techs could then operate under, or give this individual a raise in order to keep them from going to work for, and I don't remember who the competitor was, whether it was a Walmart or a Walgreens or someplace else, but it becomes a very difficult situation in those cases, and I would tell you that I think what you have is state agencies trying very hard to stay within the appropriate range, and yet sometimes are faced with these choices where if we stay within the appropriate range, we end up costing state government and the taxpayers a substantial amount of money, or we try to find a way to fix it, and we fix it by trying to be more competitive. What I have argued for, and I think what DAS, the Department of Administrative Services, and others are working on, is to try to figure out a way to change maybe the ranges and the approach that we take to hiring medical professionals throughout state government, because it poses a very serious challenge for us. You know, dentists, doctors, again, pharmacists, and then some of the nurses and other technical trained individuals, we frankly are just generally not competitive with the market. And there's a shortage in most of those areas anyway within the country, which only drives the price and the costs up. But that was a bit of a detour, but it was a point that I hope the committee understands as we try to manage through this situation and continue to provide the level of health care that we're both required to provide and in the most cost-effective means that we're trying to provide it, which is to have as many of those events handled inside the department and not have to go to outside medical care in order to resolve it, which is at a much more expensive rate. On page 22, I'll just briefly finish up. Again, you see the other funds and federal funds information identified there. The other funds amount, again, reflected the $149 million as a result, again, of the new construction under that category and under the federal funds money. You'll see, again, this difference of the 121 versus the 117. So if there are no more questions on that, I think what I'd like to do now is just take you back to where we had left off yesterday and just talk to you briefly about some cost control approaches that the department is engaged in. I mentioned briefly already the issue of staffing reviews. We have had staffing standard reviews throughout the department in an effort to determine among the staff that we have, whether we have them at the right institutions in the right numbers. And as you pointed out, as a new institution comes online, there's a staffing pattern that's associated with that institution. And this was an opportunity to go back and review the situation essentially statewide and make changes where it was necessary to really provide what we believe to be minimum safe levels of staffing throughout the department. It wasn't a staffing pattern that a lot of management would have liked. It was not the staffing pattern, obviously, that those who were on the ground in the labor force would have liked. And we have indicated to them that that's a conversation we're also having as to where should it be versus where can it be given our current fiscal situation. But it was an attempt for us to get minimum safe levels of staffing and other non-security staffing levels equally balanced throughout the department. The operation of the Central Distribution Center, which I've talked a little bit about with some of you, revenue, which allows us to do bulk purchasing of product and the efficient movement of the product. This is a good example, I think, of the efforts the department was making. In the 95-97 time frame, we were spending about $3.33 a day on food for inmate in the 95-97 dollars. Through the consolidation of this statewide distribution center and the way we've managed purchasing, we were able to drive that down substantially. In this last biennium, we were allocated and budgeted $2.30 per inmate per day. And the savings over time, and that's in 2003, 2005 dollars. So if you factor out even the inflation, just in raw dollars, we've been able to substantially drop that by a dollar per day per inmate. And as I mentioned to some of you yesterday, when you're serving on average 27 million meals in a biennium, that makes a big difference in the kind of savings. We believe that the savings actually over that period of time allowed for us initially, I'll get the number here for you. The 97-99 time frame, we think we saved $3.1 million by centralizing the way we did our food management. In 99-01, we think we saved an additional $5.2 million over the previous approach, and $4.5 million in the 2001-2003 time frame. So from where we would have been had we stuck with the old plan. So we think it's been a very effective method. We also, just to give you an idea, are using our resources and the assets of the state for this centralized purchasing to assist both the Oregon Youth Authority and the Oregon State Hospital with both purchasing and distribution of some of their food requirements, taking advantage of the asset that the state has in the central distribution facility off of State Street. We've made a lot of effort to focus on energy usage. Obviously, as energy costs have increased substantially, as you walk through Coffee Creek, which is an example of one of our larger and medium institutions, a lot of heat, a lot of power, a lot of electricity. The department has gone forward in a number of ways to implement energy-saving costs. At our Eastern Oregon facility in Pendleton, we actually have solar panels installed at that facility, which provide a substantial amount of energy for the heating of water that goes into the boiler system that runs their steam heat system there. We've had a lot of motion sensor installation to turn the lights off when someone's not there. I made a point of reminding people that that is not the outside perimeter lights that we're referring to, but most of the lights that operate inside the office areas within the institution.
Wouldn't be good in the units either entirely.
Yeah, right. there are certain parts of our operation that have to remain lighted all the time, and as a result, there are costs associated with that. We've used technology in a number of other ways. We use a number of telephone technology to decrease travel costs with respect to hearings, video conferencing instead of travel for statewide contact with these facilities, because they are far-flung on the east side, particularly at times of inclement weather. It's been a very beneficial thing for us. We're also using and moving towards and working with the courts an increased level of that kind of communication to cut down on the number of transport to court visits to the extent that any kind of video appearances can be effective. Healthcare costs, we have a very good multi-state purchasing consortium for our pharmaceuticals, and we use a managed care model for the delivery of health care services away from an episodic care model, and believe that it has done an effective job at holding down the ever-rising health care costs within the department. And we talked a lot yesterday about the use of inmate work crews, and you're certainly familiar with the fact that, having seen some of that going on at the facility yesterday, where we can, we employ inmate work crews for both the maintenance and cleaning of the facilities, the delivery of food service, inmates that actually work in the facility at Eastern Oregon who produce the clothing that the inmates wear, and a number of other ways that we use inmate labor to control and reduce the overall cost of the operation of the department. I walked you through already the resources on those sheets that we saw, and at this point, I think what I'd like to do is, with the chair's permission, unless there are further questions about those points, start a conversation with you about the department's performance measures.
Any additional questions?
If none, please proceed.
I'm going to ask Doug to provide you a sort of a performance measure cheat sheet, and I'd like to use this as the primary thing that we want to talk about. I guess I'll start with a few opening remarks about performance measures. As a former member of the Progress Board and having worked with various agencies who were developing performance measures tied to the benchmarks, I can tell you that performance measures, in my opinion, remain an important work in process within state government. As we have all tried to move towards a more performance-based approach to measuring the effectiveness of the work that agencies do, you get some of them right, you don't get some of them right, and they need to be changed and modified. The various forms that are provided to do that include sort of an annual performance measure report, which you have behind a tab, one of the tabs you have, and then a separate report that reflects our request for changes in the measures. And if you start putting all those reports together and trying to read them side by side, it becomes rather confusing. So what I thought I'd do is start out with a general conversation with you about our performance measures and then take you into any of the particular measures that you'd like to talk about specifically. Our benchmark link, as I commented to you yesterday, is benchmark number 64, which relates to the adult recidivism rate. The current state target, which is established in the benchmark, is 28.8, and our current reported recidivism rate in our performance measure report is 30.5%. We've consistently been above the state benchmark target, and because we don't set the benchmark, the benchmark is actually established not by the Department of Corrections, but is established by the Progress Board and those who establish the benchmarks. We've never felt that it was was appropriate for us to change that target, and so we tie directly to that 28.8% target for conversations with respect to recidivism. The history has generally been above that and has for the most part hovered at or about 30% since it had been measured in association with the benchmark. The first of our five performance measures directly relate to that benchmark. They included performance measure one, which was the percent of inmates that have a corrections plan. You recall yesterday my conversation briefly with you about the creation of a corrections plan for each inmate. Performance measure two, which was the percent of inmates in compliance with the 40-hour work week or the education requirement. That's the measure 17 component. Performance measure number three, which was the percent of inmates whose correction plan was completed while they were at the Oregon Department of Corrections. Performance measure number four, which was the percent of inmates reintegrated into the community who completed their plan and did not recidivate. Obviously, the measure there was if they completed their corrections plan, how many of them that did complete did not come back to you. And then performance measure five, which was the percentage of offenders on post-prison supervision convicted of a felony within 3 years of release from prison. And so that's our base recidivism number that is almost directly tied to benchmark number 64. Mr. Chairman.
Performance measure number five, just to try to tie this into the post-prison supervision. Now, the supervision may be minimum in some cases, but how long is someone released from your facility usually on post-prison supervision?
Call
it parole. It was much easier to call it parole.
Although technically challenging, I agree with you. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I think it simply varies. The Board of Parole and Post-Prison Supervision structures the plan for the inmate as to how long they will remain in supervision when they go back into the community.
So probably some people getting off within a year, probably.
There are probably some people who get out that have very little supervision. I would say that's probably a fairly small number. I would tell you that there are probably a larger group of people who are off generally by 3 years. And that's a question that we probably have some data on that I'd be pleased to provide the committee. I think it's going to depend on the inmate's criminal history. It's going to depend on their crime category. So there's enough variables in there that I think it would be challenging to sort of make broad assumptions about the numbers of people that get off and at what particular time they're no longer under post-prison supervision.
Have you heard anything to the effect that there's, obviously I think you'd probably have some difficulty tracking these individuals in other states, but in terms of those that remain in state, of any problem with maintaining the data? I mean, in terms of our systems are adequate so that you're being informed if they're convicted in a county 200 miles away from where they were released?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm not aware of a... We have a lot of concerns in the system. I think we talked about them some yesterday about the fluidity of data and whether or not we have all the information that we need to have. The issue with respect to reconviction post-release has not been an area that anyone has expressed concern about to me. I think we are able to determine through the law enforcement data system and the court records and our relationship that with both the board and community corrections offices to generally know the status of offenders if they have been in fact reconvicted of a felony.
Just a side, a minor question.
Mm-hmm.
When it says convicted of a felony within 3 years of release of prison, I assume that includes people that committed the felony within 3 years of release, not that they had to be convicted within that 3 years.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, it actually is convicted of a felony within 3 years of release. And this gives me the opportunity to talk a little bit about the recidivism number. Recidivism is a concept that I think it takes a little bit of time thinking about it to sort of get your head around. It is not a reflection of the number of people who necessarily went out and committed new crimes. There are people who went out and committed new crimes who never were apprehended for the conviction of that crime. So it is a number that captures those individuals who had been incarcerated, who then committed a crime, were arrested and prosecuted for that crime, and then ultimately convicted for it. At any stage along the way, if one of those things didn't happen, they're not going to reflect in the recidivism number. And there's a lot of different ways to count recidivism. I would tell you that I think the way that what matters long term, as it does with I think most of these benchmarks, is that you pick what you're going to measure, and then you measure that thing consistently over a period of time, and only in doing so does it give you the long term data that you need to reflect the trend of whether you're going one direction or the other.
You're looking at the trend.
So you're really looking at the trend, and I think that's an. There are other things, obviously, as you have more inmates coming into the system and more inmates releasing from the system. It also isn't a reflection of the number of people. It is a reflection of those people who have been convicted who are reconvicted, but there's a raw number movement in that data that increases as we continue to release 4,000 people a year who have been in our system and now are released back to their community. There's a raw number movement in the number of released offenders that isn't reflected necessarily in a recidivism rate. And so while we tie back to that benchmark, and it's an important one, and it's one that we follow and tie to for measurement purposes, there are limitations no matter how you approach it in measuring recidivism. And it isn't a perfect measure, for example, on whether or not crime is up or down or how people are even feeling about crime. I don't know if any of you received the population report that the Progress Board has recently completed and released, but one of the numbers that I was a bit surprised by in that report was a substantial increase in the number of people in Oregon since the last biennium population survey that they did that were sensing that we were not doing as well with respect to criminal issues and crime as we were even a biennium ago. Those numbers jumped substantially as a lot of them stayed flat. Even the education number remained relatively constant as to how people felt like we were doing with respect to education. But when you got to how people felt we were doing as a state with respect to crime, that number changed fairly substantially in the last 2 years in the population survey. So all of that is by way of saying that I think this recidivism number has its limitations. It is an important benchmark for us to relate to, and it is the trend that we need to watch, but I don't want to over-invest the committee in what that number is really reflecting.
Representative Hanna.
May I make a comment about that? Because as we've heard in a number of our committee meetings, I think there's certainly a group of people that might be watching or listening that are new to the process or don't work in this world of corrections. So I want to say this in a way that I would understand it, because I had this conversation after being in the facility yesterday. If you talk about recidivism and you only measure it for 36 months, obviously the data again becomes somewhat skewed, because you still have people coming back after that, and we don't talk about that number, so we don't know what the number is. But probably more important to me about that number, and maybe there needs to be a way to track this, is that if the total population is growing, even if the trend line for recidivism is down, the net number of people coming back is still more. And that's the, I mean, I think you're saying that, but I think for the public to get that picture, that, you know, we could drive the recidivism rate down, but if you still have more people coming, we're releasing more people. Right. And so it's not a net decrease, even though the trend could be going the right direction. I mean, the trend line would have to be on a steep decline to ever really cross over the net number of people being less.
I think you hit it right on, and that's the limitation I think that you have to consider when you're looking at that number. I jotted down just for the committee's interest the population survey. I think the question was, how good do you think we are at controlling crime? And in the good and very good category, a biennium ago, that number was 82%. In this biennium's population survey they just released, that went from 82% to 70% in the survey of Oregon, how Oregonians feel we're doing at the issues of controlling crime. So I was a significant enough difference just over one biennium that I was surprised by the number.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Well, a couple comments about that. One, I think the local scene, the jails, local county jail space, their ability to intervene in the more minor crimes, I think that has a lot more impact on people's lives and people's perceptions than whether we're more successful with the Measure 11 crimes or the higher end. From an overall public safety point, we need to be dealing with the higher end ones. But in terms of the public perception, if somebody goes through their prowls through their cars three times in a month, that's a crime wave.
And I think it's a Mr. Chair and Representative Hansen, an excellent point. I was having a conversation with someone the other day, and I had been talking about identity theft, which is obviously a big issue and much driven by our methamphetamine issues. And I continue to refer to that in this conversation as a property crime, because technically under the statute it is a property crime. And a very sage individual looked at me and she said, it wouldn't feel like a property crime if it was your identity that had been stolen. Very much a person crime. And I think the point that you're making, Representative Hansen, is just that it doesn't feel like a property crime when it's your car that's been broken into and rifled or stolen, et cetera. That it may be property, but it's very personal.
And the other thing is as we go through this concept, even if the recidivism percentages are dropping, with the numbers of people we're incarcerating going up, are extended out that we'll, by 2153, we'll all be in jail. But
Mr. Chair, I hope Representative Hansen's wrong, but I understand where he's going.
He's very old.
I want to talk, if I can, briefly back to the sheet on the performance measures. The next five performance measures that we have relate directly to the safe and civil, productive, and efficient operations of the department. Performance measure 6 is a rate we use to determine class 1 assaults. These are the most serious assaults that occur within the institution, where someone has assaulted a staff member in a way that typically requires outside medical attention. And we measure that on a regular basis to determine whether or not we are seeing any kind of spike in the level of violence within our system. Performance measure 7 is the rate of inmate walkaways. We talked about that briefly yesterday. There was a point in the department's history where there was a substantial number of walkaways from work crews. A plan was put in place to address that, and it became an issue that the department felt like was important to measure. That's reflected in performance measure 7. Performance Measure 8 is our workers' compensation time loss claims per 100 employees, again dealing with our overall cost to efficiently operate the system and in a safe manner for our employees. Performance Measure 9 is the percentage of the department's health care cost per inmate as compared to the average Oregon Health Plan or OMAP cost per capita. And we're going to talk about that in a minute. It's one of the measures that fundamentally didn't work for us. It was an apples to oranges comparator, and it's one of the ones we're asking for approval to have changed. And Performance Measure 10, which was the rate of our electricity consumption by the department in a kilowatt hours per month, again trying to control our overall energy cost. And that's another one that we're asking for changes on. What we're asking then in our requested performance measures for 0507, and I should take a minute to explain how we did this. This wasn't just a couple of us who sat down and had a conversation about what would be the right set of performance measures for the department. After the announced reorganization in June, I brought the core functional unit management of the department together in several meetings where we laid out performance measure discussions of our old and proposed potential measures, took a lot of feedback, asked them to return to their various units and to have conversations with the staff at the very lowest and highest levels of the organization to get feedback to develop what we thought was a set of performance measures, at least that would improve where we are today with respect to the kinds of things we are measuring and reporting back to the legislature on. And I will tell you that I continue to see this as a work in process. As we move performance measures over time tied to a budget conversation, I think there are some limitations in that discussion at some point that you get to, but I also think there are ways to improve it from where we're at today. But what our changes essentially reflect is that Performance Measure 1, we were instructed actually by the last legislature to delete. This was the percent of inmates with a corrections plan. That was a measurement that everyone considered to be a measurement of activity and not a measurement that actually reflected much with outcome, and that it was really being addressed by your Performance Measure 3, which is the plan completed, also tied to your Performance Measure 4, those who actually completed their plan and didn't recidivate. So that measure was dropped in this one. Performance Measure 9 I mentioned, which is our the OMAP comparison, we compared favorably, actually, to the measure. So we had a positive outcome on the measure, but it wasn't a fair apples-to-apples comparison. The delivery of healthcare services inside the institution, given the nature of the population that we're addressing and other factors, frankly, just didn't make it a very effective measure. And so for that reason, after talking sort of to the experts both in and out of DOC on this issue, we're requesting that that measure be dropped simply because even though we could brag about the fact that we were beating it, it wasn't really measuring something that was terribly effective. And then Performance Measure 10, which is a shift not to get away from measuring our energy consumption, but to focus it on BTUs, on the British Thermal Unit measurement, as opposed to a kilowatt hour measurement, with the addition of both Two Rivers, our facility in Umatilla, and the Coffee Creek facility. We use a lot more natural gas to fire our physical plant, and the kilowatt hour usage was just not really reflecting overall energy usage within the department. So those were the changes. Then finally, our additions include we have drilled down on more than just focusing on the class one assaults. We have moved down to measuring and would like to measure our level one misconducts, which is not as serious as obviously a class one assault, but to get an understanding of how inmates are reacting to our Oregon accountability model and the business strategy that we use for our pro-social interaction, and both using positive and the negative reinforcement in that model, we wanted to measure the level of misconducts across the system to determine whether or not that's actually having the desired impact. The number of escapes from secure custody and from minimum custody facilities. So you see those two would be added as measures because we also thought that it was important to measure those separate from just inmates walking away. It made sense to have, for security purposes and for what we think the public actually expects of us in our mission, to be able to consistently measure both minimum and our more secure custody environments, and obviously we do everything we can to keep those numbers next to zero, if not zero, and that would always be the goal. But we felt it was, if we were measuring the walkaways, it was important to measure escapes from other facilities. The next would be the percentage of inmates who successfully completed transitional leave. Transitional leave the AIP program, our alternative incarceration program, which you heard Ms. Porter talk about a little bit with respect to the forecast, passed in the last legislative session, which allows for individuals who have committed certain limited crimes to be engaged in a very intensive drug and alcohol restructuring and cognitive program. And if they successfully complete that program, they get a reduction in their sentence. These are only inmates who would qualify for that, so the non-Measure 11 offenders and other crimes that were included in the statute. And then they would receive a certain amount of transitional leave where they would be under DOC custody, under community supervision in that transitional leave period. Also, there is a small amount of inmates who receive and can receive under the statute transitional leave, and this would measure how successful we were with respect to those transitional leave environments and how many of them we were having to bring back in the system for violating transitional leave. And then finally, the percentage of release plans submitted by the department to the parole board and the Board of Post-Prison Supervision at least 60 days before the projected release date. The board has to have a period of time in which developing the terms of release and supervision for the individual inmate. This was becoming a problem where the department was not delivering to the Board of Parole and Post-Prison Supervision the information in time for them to adequately prepare the supervision release plan for the inmate prior to them going back out into the community. We think we've gone a long way to solving this problem, but because it is such a critical step in the process of successfully transitioning this inmate back to the community and working with both our community partners and the board, we thought that it was important to identify as a performance measure so we could continue to make sure that we were tracking our success in providing that information to the board in a timely and efficient manner. So those are our performance measures, both the old ones, the ones we're asking for modification and deletion of, and the new measures that we present to the committee and the legislature for our next biennia. And our hope is that while we might have some slight additions at times to really try to slow down on the changes and the modifications so we can actually track these over a significant enough period of time to determine whether or not we've set the targets appropriately and whether we're achieving them.
Mr. Williams, can we also get some data on your institutional side, by institution, on, I'll use the general term that you used, the rate of absenteeism for employees, use of sick leave, and the rate of overtime by institution. And I know there are explanations at some institutions for those, but sooner or later the overtime issue is probably going to come up, at least for discussion in the committee.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, we have prepared for the committee in the Phase 2 portion of the presentation a discussion about overtime. It was the subject of a budget note. We reported on the department's efforts with respect to that issue in the e-board. Please provide the committee sort of the nature of the report that we provided the emergency board during the session. We would also discuss the budget note, particularly in the Phase 2 portion of the presentation. And we can provide the same information with respect to where we are with sick leave usage throughout the department and on an institutional basis by institution.
They are in some ways so connected in terms of absenteeism, need for overtime, overcrowded facility, overworked, need to get out of the facility.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I should say on the overtime front, since the time of the budget note that the last legislature asked the department to monitor this issue, we've developed a substantial effort into tracking by institution overtime usage. And not only the amount, but classifying it based on what was the underlying driver of the overtime. Whether it was overtime as a result of people being called up for military service, sick leave, bereavement leave, out for training, because we obviously have to cover the training period as people are out for the week of training, which always has some impact on overtime. So we would be pleased to provide the committee that information. I would tell you that I think with the fact that we have created these temporary emergency beds within the facility and the forced vacancies, which we were required to maintain during this last budget period, I have certainly heard from staff about the challenges associated with forced and mandatory overtime. And I would be misleading the committee if I didn't tell you that I thought that there was a relationship to the amount of overtime that people within the department are required to put in at the facility, and that relationship tied directly back to an increase in the use of sick time. They're absolutely, I think, connected, and it's something that I think, you know, we're obviously working on and concerned about. At the same time, I think we've got a staff who work incredibly hard and have a significant responsibility, and those things, you know, we have and always, I think, have had a higher than average sick leave usage in the Department of Corrections, in part, I think, just given the nature of the business that we're in.
I wanted to bring that up basically because it's another one of those things about institutions, is that, you know, somebody doesn't show up in the morning. You, in many cases, can't leave the shift unfilled. You've got to have somebody to fill the slot. So,
yeah, Mr. Chairman, that's exactly right. I mean, we have sort of priority posts that have to be filled, and sometimes that means keeping somebody on shift. So if someone doesn't come in because they've called in sick, until someone can be relieved, that means that person is forced to stay on shift until their relief arrives. Are there any further questions?
Yes.
A couple, hopefully real quick ones. On your new measure, the number of escapes from secure custody, when was the last time there was an escape from secure custody?
I'm going to struggle, Mr. Chairman and Representative Hansen, to give you a year. I want to say it was Christmas Eve, 1998.
2000.
It was Christmas Eve. I'm hearing different years. I thought it was earlier than that, but it might have been 2000 or 2001 was the last escape from.
So I certainly understand the importance of the issue that you'd be measuring, but it seemed to me that the occurrence is so infrequent that it's not really a performance measurement. It's something that I think falls under a different category, something that should be reported or discussed, but not, it's not necessarily a measurement.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hansen, we had some of that discussion. We had some of that discussion internally, and I will tell you that not having grown up as a corrections professional in my own career path, it took me a little while to understand the level of passion surrounding that measurement. But I would tell you that in my conversations with people, both within Oregon and professionally around the country, there is nothing that shakes the foundations of a correctional organization more than an individual who escapes from one of your secure custody units. That is the hallmark of whether or not you are meeting the very fundamental thing that the public expects of your department and your agency. And there was a lot of passion internally about making sure that we were constantly measuring ourselves against essentially the gold standard of the corrections business, is can you keep the people that you have been told to keep secure and confined, both secure and confined. And it's for that reason that we thought that it was significant enough to measure. And it's also something, frankly, that you measure against other systems around the country. So it's one of those pieces of data that you have the ability to compare how you're doing to other states around the country with respect to continuing to manage this population. That was the rationale, I think, for including it as a measure. Mr. Chairman?
Well, I was just thinking. I'm trying to think if my memory is correct. Didn't Diane Downs get away from the Oregon Women's Correctional Center for a short period of time?
the chair would have the chair would have an accurate recollection of that event.
I think that was in news stories for quite a long time.
it is the very basic thing that the public expects of us. I think first and foremost is that once we have them in our custody, we are good enough to keep them there. And that's not to say that escapes don't occur, because they do. And every time escape occurs, there is something learned by that process within the department. And I could give you a list of procedures over the years that have been developed and changed at each institution as a result of someone, you know, poking at the weakness eventually until they figured out a way to actually make it successful. But we, you know, we make every effort. And this gets back to an issue that Representative Wisnant raised yesterday about the security audits that we do. One of the reasons that we perform those security reviews at each institution with a comprehensive team drawn from other parts of the department is to have somebody other than the people who are running that institution look at those practices and policies to see the things that you might see every day that after a while you're not paying attention to or that don't seem out of the ordinary. And it is that constant effort at vigilance within the system that I think keeps the system both safe and secure. If the committee has no other questions on the performance measure portion, I'd like to...
Yes, Ms. Wilson has a question.
I don't have a question, Mr. Chair. I just want to remind members that the department has brought forward new measures that will have to be acted on by the subcommittee during the work session, and I encourage you to think of any others that need discussion and make that part of the Phase 2 discussion. So if you do have any concerns or ideas for other measures, bring them forward and I can transfer them to, or transmit them to the department so they can talk about them in Phase 2. As an example, I'll probably talk to the agency some about, since medical care is such a large component of the budget and is a major activity, really taking away the only medical care one. And I don't know if there's another one could use, but it's probably worth discussing that a little bit.
Yeah, and we'd be pleased to have that discussion. We ourselves have kicked around an appropriate medical care measure, and it's difficult to find something that actually is doing anything other than just charting activity, which we try to avoid as much as we could.
Where would you?
Oh. Well, I think we should point out that the chair's memory seems to be much clearer and on events that occurred in the previous century.
Well, I actually decided yesterday that it was unfair to be in this position and to use this position for ulterior motives. So.
I appreciate the chair's acknowledgement of that on the record. Very, very much appreciated.
Even though I did not actually bring up the case, you had another case, and I can't remember. I think it's the person that they classified as the I-5 killer that escaped, in a laundry truck, if I remember. Yeah, they're nodding back.
History before me, Mr. Chairman, I can assure you. What I was hoping to do now was to walk the committee briefly through our affirmative action plan, and to just, you'll find that in a tab in your materials, and there's a considerable amount of data with respect to how the department is currently doing with respect to affirmative action. I thought I would touch just on a few highlights of that information and not walk you through the entire report. But would be pleased to talk about any portion of it that you would be interested in. We have increased the number of women that we have, and I'll start out with some remarks about women. We have increased the number of women that we have in the past biennium to where our percentage is now nearly 21% of our security force. The security classifications within the department are women. Now, because of the impact in the time frame over time, corrections was, I think if you talk to people who've been around the system for many years, they will tell you that there was a very limited role that women played originally and over the history of the department. That has changed substantially, but because the changes have come later rather than sooner, it would be our female population that would also be at some of the greatest risk should we be forced to make staffing reductions. So they've been more recently hired and them with respect to seniority. You know, there are fewer of them in those senior positions in the staff level. Our minority representation within the security ranks in the department is close to parity, both in overall representation and within our management ranks of captain and lieutenant. And we have reached parity with respect to individuals of Hispanic origin. We're still below parity with respect to our minority population overall, although I will say that with respect to African-American employees within the department, we exceed what is currently in the civilian workforce, but we're still a couple of percentage points below where we would be at parity within the department. Obviously, some of our expansions throughout the state have created some opportunity to bring a new level of diversity in areas of the state that have been underrepresented, and also to provide opportunities for some groups to be more to have greater access to employment within the department. I point out, for example, that were we to locate the facility in Madras, as proposed in the governor's budget, the access to both increased Hispanic population and Native American populations with the proximity to Warm Springs would enhance our ability to impact diversity as a result of hiring in those communities. With respect to female employees in upper management, the department is close to parity for women in the upper management portion of the department at 36%. Three out of our 12 superintendents around the state are women, and they're all at our medium custody facilities at OSCI, at EOCI, and at our facility in Snake River. 19% of our assistant superintendents are female. The challenge that we have right now with respect to our female population and their representation is really in the middle management ranks. We have strong representation in the upper management ranks of the department and in the security staff ranks at the lowest level in the department. What we struggle to have is our middle management ranks with a sufficient number of women, and that's an issue that is under discussion in the department. We use a variety, and they're identified in the report, a variety of means to reach out to minority population, including advertising positions in various periodicals that target those minority populations. We also have links and use those to various internet sites that we also think will provide us access to those populations so they're aware of the jobs and the availability of jobs within the Department of Corrections. We do a number of efforts where we make visits and presentations at various job fairs and career fairs on college campuses, and we do some small amount of out-of-state neighboring states, particularly when we're attempting to open a new facility or we have a particular hiring need. I'll give an example with respect to some of our east side facilities where we've been running high numbers of vacancies. We've actually worked out and made presentations and attempted to recruit from military personnel who are leaving the military at the Mountain Home Air Base in Idaho, which is, you know, in close proximity generally to some of our east side facilities, and there's a fair number of people who work for the department and had military background, and so we think it's a good place to try to recruit, and typically because the military has a fairly good representation of minorities throughout its ranks, it's a good place for us to get access to a potential minority workforce who might be interested in having employment with the department. We also have our classification compensation manager in our HR department has also been given the responsibility of also being our diversity manager, and we are continuing to work with a program to promote increased diversity throughout the organization. The focus strategy that includes both recruitment, training, and education. One of the areas that we probably struggle with the most is the representation of people with disabilities, and they continue to be substantially underrepresented in the department. As you well are aware, more than half of our workforce are in the security class, which has specific requirements that DPSST has created for the level of physical activity and requirements of the job, obviously working in those positions, which is to some degree a limitation on the ability to get is the level of people with disabilities that we'd like to have employed with the department. But there are a number of non-security classified jobs, and we think one of the challenges is making sure that people with disabilities understand that there are numerous jobs within the department that do not require those kinds of physical characteristics. And that those opportunities do exist within the Department of Corrections. So efforts have been made to work with the Oregon Disabilities Commission and other organizations to advertise the possibility of employment with the Department of Corrections and to make people aware of those opportunities for hiring purposes. There's considerable additional information in the report. Those are the highlights that I wanted to touch on with the committee, and I'd be pleased to talk about any of those issues specifically if you have any questions.
This is a little bit of a stretch for, but it brings up an issue in terms of like affirmative action in terms of hiring practices. And I'm just trying to relate it to an area where maybe you could just give us a brief overview of how you try to address some of those affirmative action issues and your basic need issues when you open a facility like Lakeview. I don't know what your staff requirement is there. I could guess it might be in the neighborhood of 150 staff members.
That's about right, I think, Mr. Chair, somewhere in that neighborhood.
Of what process you go through, both trying to recruit new... You said that, but you're probably trying to get them from the local people, from the local community also. You're probably trying to move some staff there that have some experience,
right,
so that you have a portion of your staff that has some experience,
right,
beyond just the new superintendent of the facility.
Mr. Chair, we typically, when we open a new facility, attempt to target an amount in working with the local community of individuals that we believe that we can hire from the local community to help staff the facility. And obviously, people who've already made the choice to live in a community, as opposed to being essentially moving in for the job, we consider to be, you know, prime candidates because they've already decided this is where they want to live, and here's a new job opportunity for them. It varies community to community as to what that target number is, but a substantial number, we hope to hire a substantial number of the employees to run a facility within the community where we're opening it. In areas like Ontario and Lakeview, for example, that is always, it always presents a challenge. The legislature didn't authorize us any operating dollars for the Lakeview facility in the last biennium, so we were authorized to build the Warner Creek facility, but we didn't have any startup dollars associated with that. So to start the process of recruitment and hiring, we've essentially used resources internally that we've diverted from other purposes so we can be ready to open that facility in September. And that includes, just recently we announced the hiring of the superintendent for that facility, and their job will be between now and September to essentially assemble the team that can be ready to actually crack the doors on that facility on September 1, make it operational when we need it to be operational for the incoming bed camp. That means being actively involved in the hiring process. Our recruitment manager has spent a considerable amount of time over the last couple of years working with the local community and neighboring local communities, including going into California and Nevada and making sure and running job fairs there for people who might be within driving distance, essentially, of coming in and working at the facility. We've also used a process internally to advertise for people in the department who would be willing to transfer to Lakeview, because you're absolutely right, Mr. Chairman. It takes a mix to open a facility. You can have a substantial number of new people who've never worked for the department, but you do need a core group of individuals who understand the department's policies, practices, and procedures, and have some years of correctional experience in order to make that work right with the right level of managers, and not just even in the security side, which is most about half of that facility as I recall, the positions are tied to the security positions. But then you've also got physical plant, food service, and various other areas where, you know, it's different than maybe they've had experience with in corrections before. We have done open recruitment. We did an open recruitment on the superintendent's position where we opened it up not just within the department, but we opened it up broadly. We had 8 candidates. We involved the community where they participated in the selection process, and there was an agreement both between the DOC staff that participated in that process and the community as to who the number one candidate was for that position. We try to involve the community at every level. We've done job fairs. We have posted regular information in the newspaper as to the time frame and what the applications are, what the requirements are, because it is a law enforcement position. Not everyone who wants to work for us, we want to have work for us. So we are a selective employer. It takes the right kind of person and requires the right kind of background checks and those other issues that we're required to go through before we hire somebody to work for the department. So it's a substantial effort. Once they're hired, particularly if they're not a transfer employee, then they'll go through the DPSST training early in their process, and that's a 5-week training at the Department of Public Standard Training and Practices, which will be moved out over here, but is now in Monmouth. They'll go through that training to be DPSST trained and certified. And so it is a real process to move from zero to full operation of a facility when we open someplace that's new. But we are constantly looking in that process with all those other limitations that I've just talked about to ensure that we are continuing to try to press forward with our goals that we have established for ourselves and that have been established in conversations with the governor's office and the legislature with respect to affirmative action.
Okay. Any additional questions? Where would you like to go next?
Well, I think now, if it would be okay, we'd go to the very next tab, which is the agency priority list. And I apologize in advance for the incredibly small print on this sheet. But I think what you have reflected on this sheet is an understanding of our agency-wide priority ranking, which we were asked to do tied directly to the 10% reduction exercise in the governor's that we're required to do from the governor's recommended budget.
Representative Wisnett has a question, I believe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The question is for you, Mr. Chair. Can you give me some further training? And as we go through these numbers, I mean, how detailed do you know, should we be looking and asking? And or is, are we going to, you know, to you and you to the co-chairs, are we going to be recommending, you know, deletion of, you know, workforce development or reducing it 10% or...
Well, Mr. Wilson might comment. I think actually in some ways it would be good. It's too bad that we're in like the beginning of the process. And I think when we get to the actual second phase of the process, we will have the full report from the Department of Corrections, and you will have detail down to the facility level in terms of how many FTE are in this facility and how many custody staff. And to some degree, and this is not meant... I mean, we will depend a lot on Mr. Wilson here to make recommendations and working with the department should cuts need to be made. But we'll look in considerably more detail.
But I guess, Mr. Chair, follow up. I could ask a lot of questions to try to get down to how, you know, what hours they're working and things like that. Is that? I mean, if that's.
I would guess actually, we in this level of a department, we probably won't entirely get down to that level because we'll be discussing more what the staffing levels potentially are, or what facilities might open or not open in this biennium, and what the ramifications that will be. Unfortunately, I think what happens is when we get some budget from some very tiny agency, we often spend 45 minutes discussing whether or not to add a half an FTE when we don't really spend 2 hours discussing what the staffing level is in a major institution. But I'll turn it over to Doug.
Mr. Chair and members of the subcommittee, the intent of talking through the priority list this time is really to take a look at the programs, not necessarily at this point to dive into the dollars. What the co-chairs are looking for are a list of what you feel are the priorities in the agency. And a couple things you should also look at, is this the breakdown that you would like, or do you need further information? And you're really judging the importance of a program to a program within the agency. I mean, the dollars, if you need to understand the dollars to a point to understand the program, that's important. But getting to sort of the number of FTE and some of that stuff really is, comes a little later. Because that's to say, you're ranking programs for maybe a couple programs toward the end of the list that you say, you know, your priority list says take them off. You get rid of that program completely. That doesn't mean that there are cuts in the number one and two on the top of the list that can be made, and that will come during the work session portion and a little more knowledge in phase two. And keep in mind, every subcommittee is trying to sort of figure out what their role is and what the process is. It's new to us. It's new to the members like Representative Hansen and Senator Devlin, who've been here a while also, in terms of trying to sort out what this is. But I think we just go, I suggest going as you go through this. I don't think diving into real detailed information is what folks are looking at this time. It's more of getting a feel for what's important in the agency, what are the most important components or programs in the agency, and ranking them by that way at this time.
I guess I can follow up on that. Like, now, I'm not going to recommend to you, and I don't assume you're going to recommend the co-chairs that we cut out their priority one.
No, but and this Director Williams should not take this as directly reflective on the Corrections Division or on his efforts there. But it is not abnormal in this process for agencies to offer up as cuts things that they know it will be very difficult for us to cut. And sometimes we have to look deeper than that.
We've talked about how the governor's plans seem to have some real critical things just below the cut line.
Yeah. And governors sometimes actually play that game, too. And that's a shock to them back there.
Mr. Chair, this will be a difficult agency to get your hands around in terms of prioritization, because so much of it, both in terms of the number of programs and the scale of the programs, are constitutionally required. You do not have the authority without changes in law to release prisoners or inmates to any large degree. And you do have to feed them, you have to make sure they're secure, you have to have a physical plant, and that makes up the bulk of the expenditures in this agency.
Yeah.
And that's why this agency will be tougher than some other agencies. Or if you take the school fund, I mean, K through 12 is one big item. That's going to, you know, they're going to have to work through and figure out how to define that and how to split that apart.
But I get the same feeling about the public safety. It's all talked about, and that was part of our briefing that your staff, it's all interrelated. Mm-hmm. And if you cut out, you know, defense attorneys, and the system clogs down.
But I do think you'll ultimately be faced with choices within these committees for instance, where we will actually say to a department director like Mr. Williams, you know, we need you, as happened in the e-board, we need you to hold these positions vacant for another 6 months. Or we know that your overtime rate has been this, but we want the overtime rate dropped by 10%, and that's all we're going to budget. And if you go over that rate, you're going to have to eat it within the department somehow. Shaking their heads in the back. But these are the kinds of discussions you get into, or you get sent in the final days of a session down to a room and told to cut $5 million. And
So then everybody...
Yeah.
So I guess all this information we're being given and questions we're asking is to prepare us to do something like that.
Yeah. Is to try to... although departments don't always agree with those decisions, is to at least try to make the wisest decision we can make when some of those decisions inevitably will have to be made in some departments.
Okay.
And not this, not just focusing on the Corrections Division.
And Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, having lived through some of what you're experiencing in this session, myself personally, I have the greatest respect for the issues that you're having to face and the difficulties. And obviously my job representing the Department of Corrections and the Governor's budget with respect to the Department of Corrections is to give you the very best information we can about the outcomes and alternatives and impacts that would be associated with the choices that we would face. I will walk you through the paperwork that you have under this tab, so at least you understand the pieces.
Thank the chair for your comments and guidance. That was helpful. Thank you.
I'd be pleased to walk you through the pieces that we have here. I do want you to understand I'll share with you our priority list and then show you how we got there. But I want to start out by sort of understanding that the statutory requirement we have to produce a 10% reduction plan off of the governor's recommended budget would mean a reduction for us of $125 million. And as you've seen sort of our general budget presentation at this stage and the size of the agency and how we spend our resources, the only way that the department gets to that size of a 10% reduction of $125 million includes the closure of facilities. That there's not $125 million anywhere else within the system that could get you to the operations of the department without the closure of facilities. And so what you'll see in our 10% reduction plan discussion is the four facilities that we would have to close and then not go forward with either the opening of Madras or Lakeview, even the Lakeview facility, in order to achieve that level of reduction. And it would ultimately mean essentially the release of, I'll get you the number, but I think the release is of 1,821, so 1,821 inmates that would have to be released with the closure of those facilities, and an additional 1,264 inmates that would be theoretically coming in over that period of time that would be coming into the system that would not be able to be managed as a result of not going forward with the opening of those facilities and the savings associated with it. So I point that out at the beginning only to suggest to you that it's not an easy thing for us to go through that 10% reduction exercise and have anything but some really ugly consequences to present to the committee about how we'd have to achieve it. And that's not an effort to lay out to you, you know, sort of a whole bunch of bad options. As the chair had pointed out, the fact that we frankly don't have other places within the system to reduce given the nature of the business that we're in. It is about incarcerating individuals in those physical plants. And closing one down doesn't mean that it goes away. It doesn't have any costs associated with it. So that's sort of a prefacing comment. As you look at our agency-wide priority ranking, what you'll see on this first sheet is a sheet that we were asked by Mr. Wilson to prepare that actually ranks all of these programs essentially from 1 to 39. And that ranking was not what we had originally provided. We had provided the longer sheets on the other side, where we went through you'll see, I think, seven different areas. And if I could have you turn to the second, the first page of the long pages. As you look there, you'll see these the seven things listed there, and the program unit or activity. We had originally started with a ranking there, which was institution operations, functions and services, reentry to community, inmate management tools, transition services, construction. And then we've identified non-optional payments are the debt service requirements that and other non-optional payments that the department has. That's an overall ranking that we did in trying to determine for the department how we would rank in these broad categories what it is that we do.
Mr. Williams,
yes.
It might be good if you could look in this sort of presentation for an area that you might be able to stop in the next couple of minutes so that we don't actually get in a situation tomorrow where we're just going to have to probably repeat much of this in terms of the ranking for potential reductions, because we have about 9 minutes left.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, yes. Maybe I could ask a question that could maybe kill the rest of them. All right. So last session, Director Williams, you had to delay the opening of the Madras facility. Right. How much did that save, and what happens? I know we have the 900 new prisoners coming in, but we're going to increase Coffee Creek by 400 or something like that. How much do we save? And like you said, to get $125 million, you have to close the facility. How much do we save if we delay again opening matters?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Wisnett, we will show you data tomorrow, I hope, as we begin the conversation about the construction piece, that will reflect what the offset cost associated with the delay would be and what savings. My recollection is that in the delay from last session to this session, the savings were primarily savings associated with the startup costs, which were, I want to say, around $12 million or so.
We're still long way.
So a fairly limited amount of savings associated with that. But we'll break them down in a very careful way that I think you'll be able to see what your options are and what the impact of delay is. One of the challenges, obviously, is along with that delay in moving forward the construction, the cost of construction and the underlying material costs increased for the system by almost the amount of the savings, at least associated with the startup costs. I don't think they're one for one, but they're pretty close. What we've done is we've just either forcing us to scale back the costs associated with the facility by value engineering out things that we had originally needed in the plan, or by coming up with more money in order to buy what we were going to buy 2 years ago in order to provide for this facility. But what I hope to do tomorrow, and maybe this is the way to do this, and we won't spend a lot of time walking through the priority list tomorrow unless you want to, is to talk you through alternatives along with the costs associated with going forward with the construction as identified in the governor's budget, and then some other alternatives as it relates to, if we didn't do that, we're not going to, those bodies are still going to come into the system. There is, I think, with some people, a misconception that if you simply don't build a facility, there won't be any costs associated with those new inmates. And as you understand, that's not the case. Those inmates will come in, and to the extent we can't crowd any more within our facilities, our alternative is are to find some place else to house them. And if that housing them is in a county jail bed, that comes at a contract cost that we have to have with counties. If it is housing them outside the state, there are legal limitations to the extent of where you can house them outside the state, and capacity issues about whether or not you can meet what that legal limitation is. But we'll lay all that out, I think, in a way that at least identifies for you the numbers that we've used in doing this analysis, that will give you the assumptions that we're using to get there, the pros and the cons and the risks associated with each of these alternatives. And I think, my hope would be that it would be sufficient to provide you the information you need to understand why we still believe that moving forward with the construction of Madras is both in the short term and in the long term best interest of both the state and the legislature as you try to manage through this difficult fiscal time. Those inmates won't disappear.
Tomorrow I might suggest that you actually spend, let's say, about 20 minutes going over this priority list for reduction, so that when the actual chair of the committee comes back, I can tell her that we covered the areas we were supposed to cover, and then we'll go to the issues in terms of Madras and others, and then on to any others that, because we have a limited number of days to get through the rest of your budget in phase one,
right,
so that we stay on schedule.
And it would be
the schedule as we can get.
And I believe that the conversation about the construction choices and the issues that we're asking you to take a position on soon will eat up most of Thursday and the time that we've been allocated on the schedule for Monday as we engage you in that discussion. And
I'd be pleased full day on Monday.
Yeah,
so.
And I'd be pleased to take you through tomorrow how we did the process. If in the couple of minutes maybe that I've left, I'll tell you what we did, and then we can talk about the specifics of the choices we made. We broke up the department into those seven categories, as you see there, and then the follow-on sheets behind that, what's identified as page one of the long sheet, you have in each of those individual areas broken up as well. So you'll notice that our number one priority ranked by the department was institution operations. As you move to page two, you have institution operations then prioritized under institution operations 1 through 11, these are major functions within this program unit and activity description within institution operations that is necessarily laid out there for you, and we demonstrate what that is and the priority we put on that. If you move to number page 3, you'll see that we did the same thing with functions and services. Now, I will tell you that we intentionally did not do this by division. So operations, institution operations, is not just the operations division. We attempted to demonstrate the fact, appropriately so, that we weren't doing a division by division priority, but we were prioritizing based on function and need across the department. So in functions and services, you'll see health services, which is part of the operations division, listed as the number one priority for functions and services, and you'll see alcohol and drug treatment listed as number 5, which is part of transitional services. So we didn't do it by division. We did it by the importance of the level of the function within the department. The third area is reentry to the community, inmate management tools, transition services, construction, and then I believe the last page is the non-optional payments. So that's how we provided the information. We were then asked by Mr. Wilson, I believe the co-chairs, to essentially synthesize that information where we prioritized among each of those areas our number one priorities. We were then asked to say, well, put it all together in one big pot and compare all those against each other and choose 1 through 39. And so the small print sheet you have on your front page is that ranking as best we could do it to make those choices. And this is really, to a great degree, I think, where this process, in my opinion, starts to break down somewhat, because our number one ranking was institutional food service. Assuming you have these people, you're required to feed them. And yet, to say that it somehow ranks higher than security and housing begins to start to already, I think, demonstrate the challenge you have in comparing, or health services for that matter, that comparing these things that truly aren't optional with respect to what we're obligated to provide. We did the best we could with that, but I want you to understand not only our view, but I think other people's view of the limitations on some of this ranking at this level across an agency that has the kind of restrictions that ours has. So I share that with you as a preface. As you look at this perhaps later today or this evening in preparation for our discussion tomorrow, to understand the approach that we attempted to make as we provided this information as we were requested by Legislative Fiscal and the co-chairs. So with that, Mr. Chair, unless there are other questions, I'll stop and look forward to beginning our discussion at this point tomorrow.
Final questions? Hearing none, we are adjourned until tomorrow at 1.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.